Any questions people would like to ask Jill or points they'd like to make?
Yeah. Can I just ask one about his attitude to women's suffrage forum?
About his attitude to women's suffrage. I think when women were initially struggling, one aspect of the party's attitude was that the sort of women who were actually fighting for it were in fact women who either owned property or were the wives of the property owning class, and therefore that to give that group, because you see women at that point were asking for votes on the same terms as men. Now I think at that point it was only certain property-owning sections of the male population who had the vote. I don't think full franchise for men came until later. So I think at that point, in that context, the party were actually saying that to give votes to the women, the particular sort of women who were campaigning for them at that time, it would be votes for property. Now, I'm not sure, I mean, I don't know, probably somebody else in the room might know more about this than I do. I'm not sure what happened later with that situation. That's just right at the very beginning.
Yes, Sandy.
Well, I think possibly Steve Coleman or somebody who knows more about party history could be a bit more definitive about this, but my understanding of another point that was made was precisely the point which you opposed, rightly, I think, in the talk. There was an attitude that, you know, if you could get enough of the, namely men, who actually had the vote, That was all you needed to do. Now, I don't know how prevalent that attitude was, and maybe somebody can correct me on that. But I have to say I'm delighted that that point was made right at the beginning of the talk. That if we're talking about getting a class-conscious majority, votes for women, if the vote is going to be used, is pretty well an inevitable part of that. And where it doesn't exist in any part of the world, whatever the party may have thought of the women's suffrage movement, and some of the criticisms were undoubtedly quite valid, that has got to be a sort of indissoluble part of the whole affair. You're talking about, this point can be made over and over and over again ad nauseum, but it seems that we've got to keep saying that you're talking about half the population, half the working class, so you can't just, it's not a side issue.
On the fact, I think the main objection of the party's propaganda organisation at the women's suffrage movement, it was not so much that women should not have votes, but that the campaign for women to have votes was couched in the normal propaganda, reformist propaganda stance. It suggested that if it was the lack of votes that meant that women experienced the problems they did. If they only had votes, that would make all the difference. It also was feared, and actually was borne out to some extent, that in the short term, women, for whatever historical, cultural reasons, being more conservative, it would have a retarding effect. And there's no doubt about it, the first woman who was elected was a Tory. And it's also true that in one or two countries I could specifically think of, the introduction of this vote was precisely as a last move to in fact stave off more radical pressures. By giving the women the vote at that point, they both, the those in power in the position to concede it, both got kudos as being the ones who made that breakthrough, but at the same time staved off pressures which they wanted to stay on. Having said that, I think the party in making those points probably erred in throwing out the baby in the bathwater, or in other words, in making its rightful dismissive comments of who was behind the women's movement, what was the likely immediate effects of it, and so on, were overlooking that women without the vote meant that half the working class was not really expected to play a part in its own emancipation. Of course, this isn't on.
And I think it's worth pointing out that, if I just read one little section of this, it says the extension of the suffrage to women upon a property basis which must exclude the majority of working women is certainly only a fresh obstacle in the path of socialism. And it is equally certain to say the least, that the gift of the vote for women is by no means indispensable to the conquest of the state by the workers. Goes on to say, I mean, there's some terrible stuff in this article, but it refers to things like, it's actually referring to a review of a book by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who's an American suffragette. And it says, much of the book also is a play upon the word human. The authoress will have it said, that fighting is not human because women do not fight. Yet it was only because men did fight that women had no need to. Without the combative qualities which Mrs. Gilman sets aside as mainly masculine, the human race would have ceased to exist. It could never have been made, headway against its multitude of its enemies. Consequently, the fighting instinct most developed in the male is and has been essential to humanity. It is a great source of hardy enterprise and progress. But it also goes on to say that talk about the natural social division of labour. It talks about the fact that women's labour power is inferior to men. It actually uses that word, inferior to men. And in general, I mean, I think the impression from this particular article is quite worrying. I mean, I think it makes some important points about the fact that, as Jill mentioned, that a lot of the women who were fighting for suffrage were the wives or property owners in their own right. But it doesn't seem to me to give sufficient emphasis to what we would now say, and say very strongly in the party, which Jill rightly pointed out, that women are necessarily a part of the movement for socialism, and seeing as we talk in terms of democracy being the means by which we can achieve socialism through the vote, then necessarily women must have the vote. So I think that the parties, from judging from this and other articles that I've read in On the Socialist Standards, the party's attitude to women the vote was, to say the least, ambiguous.
Can I?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that party's attitude was ambiguous. I think, I hope that the party's attitude has changed since then, and I for one would support women's struggle for the vote in other lands, you know, where that struggle to be going on. I'd just like to make just one point about when I at the beginning of the talk made the point about. Men can't cast the vote for women for socialism. I wasn't necessarily using the word vote in that literal sense. I mean, I was as well, but I also meant by that more generally, men within the socialist movement can't act on the behalf of women. Just act on the behalf of women within the socialist movement. I don't know if that point came across.
Yeah. Jill mentioned about Socialist Party being the only organisation organised to achieve socialism. I'm sure you must be aware that there's other organisations who work on the same aim as us but have different methods of achieving it. Maybe you'd like to talk about where we differ with them, about our method. Also, you said that it should be demonstrated for socialism. Well, I think we could demonstrate socialism, demonstrate the fact that we should take over control of our world. And another thing, I've read seen something on telly recently that children have to spend the majority of their time with their own biological mother. Otherwise, they won't develop healthily. That has, you know, implications for a social society. Because I always thought that, you know, it didn't matter to me if a child stick to its own mother or not. As long as somebody was there to make the child love and care and all the rest of it. But apparently, it does have far-reaching consequences if a child isn't with its own mother.
The first point about other movements working for socialism but making, sort of doing it by other means. Which movements? I don't know any of the movements which are working for the society which we define as socialist, propertyless, moneyless society, where people can freely cooperate with each other in production and control the productive process, and then take freely what they need from an, from the abundance of what they produce. I mean, I'm not sort of saying you're wrong, but I don't know any of the other parties who are actually working, or movements who are actually working for that aim. The second point you made is in regard to demonstrating for socialism. I wasn't really referring to, firstly, I wasn't really referring to it in that context. What I was actually saying was that in the socialist society, women would be able to take their freedom, as opposed to demonstrating for it. I mean, I was referring specifically to women in this context, and maybe women demonstrating for the rights to abortion on demand, or something like that. What the point I was trying to make, that in a socialist society, women would just live the way they wanted to. They wouldn't have to walk around the streets demonstrating for rights to do this, or rights to do that, or rights to the other. They would just live their lives in the way which they saw fit. And the third point, the child has to be with its mother when it's young. Well, you would have to. I mean, you didn't really state an age in that. I don't know what this, you know, sort of what age was put forward in this program that you saw.
Up to the first 8 years.
Up to the first 8 years. Yeah. I mean,
nonsense.
In it. Well, in. If I could just say, when I was talking about the possibilities for childcare in a socialist society, talking about communal childcare doesn't have to mean that the child can't be with its mother. I think I mentioned the point that even though children wouldn't be looked on as property, they would still probably, this is all speculation, feel more closeness to their own sort of blood parents or their own mother than they would to other people. But that doesn't mean, surely, that and obviously parents and children would want to be with each other some of the time. I mean, probably more, because you know, they would respect each other more and they would enjoy being with each other more, purely because you wouldn't get the sort of scenario which you do in this society of one isolated couple or isolated woman in some cases being with the same child 24 hours a day, caring for all its needs, and then driving each other up the wall. I mean, just because there would be communal childcare facilities, I think, available, doesn't mean that people would, firstly, have to take advantage of them. Obviously, anybody who didn't want to take advantage of them wouldn't be forced to. And secondly, wouldn't mean that, I wouldn't think that parents would sort of like just dump the child somewhere and, you know, never see them again. I mean, that wasn't the point of what I was saying. I'd just like to illustrate this a bit more. See, it's interesting. I mentioned, like, you know, the way the communities appear to be on the islands off the mainland of Greece. And it isn't that parents don't see the children. I mean, they do see the children and they do spend time with them. But the crucial point is that the rest of the community also feels a responsibility towards that child, and therefore just watches over it in a very general sense. You know, a child could be sort of like cycling madly down the street, a young person, they might fall off, and it wouldn't be a case of, you know, sort of, oh dear, we'll have to find its mum or its dad. They would sort of take some responsibility for it, because the children are considered, you know, to be a part of a community, and to be, the community generally are responsible for them.
Somebody mentioned other groups who might be working towards socialism, and you can think of anybody you can think of. I think actually that there are people who envisage something like what the Social Party might do, socialism is, but they don't actually call it socialism.
Yeah.
So, for example, quite a lot of feminists, in fact, have proposed something as a utopia along the lines of the socialist society, and perhaps a good example of that is Marsha Peters' book, One Way at a Time. And I think it's quite positive, actually, that other people are thinking in those sorts of terms. You know, I mean, obviously, the big problem with feminists who are thinking in those sort of terms is that they've got their analysis wrong. You know, they know some of the problem has to do with the relation between men and women, and they haven't got a class consciousness. So obviously what we've got to do is to try and work on their class consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But it does seem to me that there's something good about the fact that there is a sort of shared vision, and something that perhaps the Socialist Party could try and work on.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. When the questions was posed, it was posed as in other political groups who are working, and I couldn't sort of think, well, I don't think, I'll state it, I mean, there aren't other political groups who are working. But, you know, some individual sort of people who are writing books and stuff have envisaged that sort of society that I was describing. The Marge Pearson is one of them. I don't know any other sort of names of that. Marge Pearson, by the way, did envisage this sort of society based on cooperation. I think, although it wasn't specifically stated in her book, I think that it was a moneyless, propertyless society, right, which she envisaged, which, you know, where people worked communally, they contributed what they could to the process of production. Then they might take, you know, women might go away and travel for a year, and then do like sabbatical and stuff like that, and then they might come back. And it was the work patterns in the society that Marge Pearson envisaged were very sort of flexible and allowed. And there was a wonderful sort of vision of childcare, of care of young people in that society, where the young people had a much vaster amount of freedom. In fact, they weren't. You were probably only really dependent on their parents when they were absolutely tiny. You know, when they couldn't sort of move to. And after that time, because there wasn't the degree of danger in society, because it was a society where you could take what you needed, they became very independent of older people at a very early age. And
in relation to this question of children, I would like to point out that in so-called Puritan society, that is in hunter-gathering society, this has been estimated by people who have investigated this very closely, that about 70% of the food food and hunting society subsisted on was gathered by the women. And the method of doing this was for the women to go with the children. And it was the responsibility of the women as a whole to look after the children as a whole. And as a matter of fact, the character-forming process, which is necessary to growing children, was developed in that way. Now, in contrast to this, I'd also like to draw your attention to a book which was written by Margaret Mead called Sex and Temperament in Three Primitive Societies. And this is a description of society not on the food and not on the food gathering and hunting basis, but in tribal society, which is quite different, where a certain amount of private property relations existed. Nevertheless, in New Guinea, where this study was carried out, there were three tribal groups living quite close one to the other, and all three cultures were different. The children under that lived in the tribal community, the Arapesh, were brought up as well-behaved children with consideration for other children and for adults. And it was generally a very cooperative kind of society. On the other hand, the other two societies were entirely different. One was brought up, the children in one particular society were brought up to be antagonistic, to be aggressive. And that is, in fact, how they turned out. So it's an example, really, of how children's character can be moulded by the kind of society they're living in. And quite frankly, This example that was given by a comrade over here of children having to, of necessity, be with their natural mother, as it were, is not borne out at all in anthropological experience.
You were talking about other movements. There's a movement I came across some while ago called We Money. I disapprove of the term money. But the idea behind that was that people exchange services and goods in the sense that they registered with whatever they did and they could take whatever they needed from the common pool and exchange whatever they were doing without actual exchange of money. The idea of that was to undermine the monetary or capitalist society by making it possible to exist without reference to it. I mean, I've done that all my life to some extent, exchanging techniques for various goods and services and so forth, but it could be done on a larger scale. I think there are some primitive societies which operate on the basis of being a gift society rather than selling or buying or owning property. It's considered more honourable to give things away, and they quite happily have a practice of giving things away to one another rather than exchanging them or accepting any payment for them. I don't see why this shouldn't be extended to normal society, because we all give gifts to our personal friends. The habit of doing so could be extended to everybody.
I don't want to come back. It's the gentleman next to the person with the hand up, with the beard, who had his hand up earlier.
Yeah, there were two points on the show. In relation to what has just been said, I think the answer, it seems to me a fundamental difference between what the Socialist Party has as its objective and this notion of the big economy, which has just been spoken about. One is a misunderstanding of what capitalism is all about. It is based upon a naivety in relation to the market, because you cannot, within the market system, opt out, can't within the market system to any significant extent which breaks down the market, get away from the iron law of profit. So you have to recognise that you either have capitalism or you have socialism, and you can't begin to operate some kind of free exchange within a capitalist society without it, of course, becoming crushed. If it's done in the name of socialism, it totally discredits the socialist idea and it is seen by people looking at it as another failed utopian experiment, which of course these people are advocating it. I don't know the particular movement to which our friend refers, but I mean, they can look at the whole history of the cooperative movement, the whole history of American utopian movements, which attempted to get outside the exchange economy by giving gifts to each other, by being somehow freed in their own consciousness. It's pure utopian idealism. And whilst people here might have a certain amount of sympathy for what motivates it, those kind of people have to give up those ideas and get involved in socialist movement, which is based upon a clear understanding of capitalism. You can't have socialism unless you know what it is that you're getting rid of, which is capitalism. But I do want to ask a question to the speaker, and that is, the title is Why Women Should Join the Socialist Party. No question about it, in everything we've heard this weekend, especially from the speaker, why you should be a socialist is clear. I don't think anyone in this room actually probably doubts that you ought to be a socialist. There's almost unanimity on it. There are just a few thousand million outside who need convincing on that, but let's not worry about them. They're all watching Sunday football and they're living and making the trumpet in the kitchen bowl and then drinking the beer and watching the Everton being beaten. But what is so that part of it, of course, is clear. Why you should be a socialist. why is, of course, summed up, what socialism is summed up, and I think we know about that. The problem, I think, and the problem that recurs in all of the activity of this organisation in addressing the people's is join. Why you should join something. People don't like joining them. I don't particularly like joining things. People prefer not to be part of an organisation. It's far easier to agree with it. And in a way, I want to ask you the question, what do you say to people then and say, we know why you should be a socialist? We think that the Socialist Party is the vehicle for talking about that, because when all said and done, we're the only ones who do. I mean, it's all very well talking about a utopian novel written once, which you go and buy in a bookshop, and when you finish reading it, you might dream about it two nights running, but that's not really going to change the world. It's going to simply mean that, you know, you dream. But why should people join? Because I suspect that at the end of this meeting today, people will be leaving this room. Those of us who are committed to the work of the Socialist Party, which I think is A, valuable work, B, enjoyable work, C, urgent work, very often bloody boring work, tedious work, the kind of work that people who join the Socialist Party undertake in order to maintain the idea of socialism as something being practically put before people. We're going to carry on doing that. I don't see anyone leaving the Socialist Party as a result of you asking them to join it. So totally stopped up the event. On the other hand, what you've got to do in order to totally make this ecstatic and fulfill the event, well, at least you haven't really got to do it yourself, you've all got to do it, is what happens to these people who walk out of the door who say, well, that's a good idea. The Socialist Party does stand for socialism. Socialism is what we want to bring about. But we're not going to join it. I want you to try to think about why it is that people are not going to join it, women in particular, although I don't really care with women or men, and anyone, animals, if, you know.
What can the ever
originally organise as baboons?
Through the chair, please.
The question is, why do people not do that? What do you say to address those reasons? And that question is directed as much to those people as to the speaker.
I'll just reply to that quickly. I don't know what you can say to people apart from saying that, which I thought that I had, was that, you know, socialist society was the only society, by the way I defined it, which could end women's oppression and provide for their full emancipation. And as we are the only party who's working for that aim, then it seems to me logical that women should join us. But I can't address the individual sort of reasons, psychological reasons why people may not join, or why I don't know why people don't like joining groups, because I can only talk from my own experience in that, and I did want to join. So I'm sorry if anybody else has got any other ideas.
Correct, Steve. First of all,
hang on. There was the guy next to the. Did you want to?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a small point about the entire party. That isn't really a problem with the working class, it's a problem with the capitalist class.
Yeah.
Because the capitalist class are the ones that have to manage and send a kid away to the local school, etc.
That's
exactly what was my mind. Does that mean then that if they spend their time with their matching and mother, then they'll have a set of food capitalists?
One whole section of Jill's talk is about pornography, really, which come into the discussion. Well, the sexual exploitation of women, which dealt largely with pornography. And some of the gut-wrenching examples that she gave can really only lead to one conclusion. And their conclusion is that people have to wonder what type of society it is that throws up enough people who get satisfaction out of it to form a market. And if this twisted society is capable of forming a market around something so revolting, then really what is the point of trying to do anything about pornography within this society? Because if it can do that, if it can make ordinary human beings want to look at the type of things that Jill was talking about, and according to certain evidence, having looked at it, want to go out and do it, then really it's, surely it, the propaganda argument about pornography is that the only way to change it is to change the society which produces it.
Yes. I mean, I would like to say, I mean, you say what sort of society would sort of lead people to want to look at these particular things? Well, it's a power society, isn't it? Our society is based on power. Power relations permeate all sort of relationships that people have with each other, and I think that's the basis of it. Plus, it's a brutalizing society, and people become brutalized. I mean, I don't think we should get, you know, I mean, it's horrific, but I don't think we should sort of like get it out of that context. People are brutalized all the time by what's going on in the world, by wars, by starvation, watching people starve, in all sorts of ways. And it's in this context, I think, and the context of the power, you know, power relationships in this society, that people actually do look at things like that. You know? And yes, I mean, obviously the way to change that is to change the brutalizing power mad society. But I mean, having also said that, I mean, I on an individual level, it's, you know, if I was ever sort of like subject to somebody looking at that sort of stuff in front of me, or, you know, I would not lay into them, but verbally, yeah.
If you actually want to change society because you're not satisfied with the way it is, then you have an idea that might be better, then you need the responsibility to be active in doing that. And the Socialist Party provides the vehicle for doing that. From the Socialist Party, you can cooperate with men and women who share those ideas with you, and you can take part in cooperatively in the educational process if you bring about change. And that's why you should join the Socialist Party. Why you should be active.
Yeah, well, I want to add a wider to that. I would agree with everything what Queen has said. But my response to Steve's question that he posed was, in my particular experience of people that have been around the party, and this is what Steve's really talking about, those people we sometimes refer to as sympathisers, my experience has been that people who are not actually joined the party, obviously there's all different reasons, you can't really generalise, but to generalise, I would say that they don't really see socialism as a practical alternative. That's basically, I think, you know, to be quite honest, I don't think these people really understand the implications and really believe that socialism is a practical alternative. It's very good to turn up to Socialist Party meetings and gassing off, you know. But when it really gets down to changing society, which is a serious thing and you know, constitutes getting involved and doing work and doing the things that a lot of people don't like to do generally, that's it. They don't want to, that's far as their commitment goes. You know? So, you know, my response to Steve is that, you know, some people you would be able to sway to get in the party. We have to accept that there'll be other people, even when the movement's going, there'll be a large section of the community, I'm quite sure, that still won't want to get involved for those reasons.
Yeah, I'm just sort of asking a general question to all members really. Why there's this heavy emphasis on having to join the party? Isn't it enough if there are people who are sympathetic, who are prepared to do work for the Socialist Party, but who don't necessarily want to join? At Bristol Branch, I think Keith knows that there are lots of people at Bristol Branch who are sympathetic, who do occasionally chip in and do work for the party, and who don't join. and that might be a set as cause of, I don't altogether understand why it's a cause of such frustration for members of the party if, after all, these sympathisers are doing some work. And also, I think that party members might bear in mind that there are often very good reasons why people don't join. I'm sure everybody's very well aware that the capitalists are against us and that it's very easy to get blacklisted. And I was speaking from my own personal experience. You know, I've done enough shitty jobs in my life so far, such that at the moment when I'm training to do a job that I would like to do, I'd like to actually be able to get a job at the end of it. And I suspect that joining part of the party at the moment might mean that I couldn't. That seems to me quite a good reason.
I don't want to come back. Okay.
I've seen you, Sandy. Yeah,
on that last point, I think people sometimes overestimate the extent to which blacklisting would have ever taken us to. I can never say that. No, I think we're interested in people becoming involved, as you say, rather than signing on some form or got in mind. Having said that, there are certain points to joining which are somewhat different to coming in to get involved. The main one of which is to do with democracy. When we take a being, I would argue, the only seriously democratic movement at the moment. We take democracy dead seriously. And for example, in setting up an event like this, there's had to be dozens of decisions made, which generally are made in the most democratic way possible. So votes are being taken on things like what an event should be called, just as an example. Well, clearly, if you're going to have a system of voting, you've got to have your constituency who you're out to vote. And if you allowed anyone who wanted in, and you weren't quite sure who they were or what they were to vote, and people could start influencing those votes who ultimately were hostile to it. So you have to have somehow register who's with you and who's against you for that reason, if no others. That's part of the patriotic vote. But I wanted to make a few other quick points on other things that have come up over what I think is a very interesting discussion. On the question of children up to the age of 8, I think the reason for that is the property idea that children or young people up to the age of 16, in fact, or 18, are regarded as the physical and mental property of their parents in capitalist society. And mothers in particular are charged with the role of conditioning children into the ideas of capitalism, which is a very dirty judgment. Even if so, that, you know, the mother, as it were, is very often expected to play quite an active role in. Another point was made about the fact that we should run meetings and so on, make them more accessible. I can just say, from an organisational point of view, that it's interesting to note that the Socialist Party in this area runs a lot of meetings during the week at night. And in fact, the proportion of women who come as visitors to meetings which we hold here at Paxton House is noticeably higher. We found this time after time than it is when we run meetings on a Thursday night. Now, we continue to do both regularly, but it's just worth bearing in mind just how true that is. I wanted, finally, to come on to what I think is clearly the most important point of the day and indeed the weekend, which has just started to emerge here, about why it is, in fact, that people, and women in particular, should sort of go as far as to join this movement. And I'd like to relate that to a point that, in fact, Jill, the speaker, made earlier on. I think she made a very interesting point early on in her comments when she said that people who aren't really capable of getting socialism, who don't have the capacity, democratically and so on, to organise themselves and getting it, are hardly likely to be very capable of participating democratically in it. So the two are part of the same thing. And you can read that the other way, that people who are going to be really understand to be democratic within a socialist future form of society also are going to be able to do that now. So I would say on that basis that one, for me, the most strong argument I could find for saying to people why you should go ahead and join us and become involved in it is actually to prove us right, in a sense. I mean, we have arguments occasionally with opponents of socialism about the idea that human nature makes socialism impossible. Of course, it's a common argument, a common myth. And obviously, as socialists, we've got very strong arguments to prove why that claim is untrue. But in my view, the ultimate argument we've got is a kind of practical one. We point around the room and we say, look, if human nature is always going to be vicious and violent and lazy and all the rest of it, then why is it that there are dozens of people in this room voluntarily coming along, doing a lot of work, getting things going? So in that sense, I would say that the most we can urge people in this room to do, having yet become fully involved in that, is to say, look, try and see. Well, if you actually become involved in this, then you're attempting, in practical terms, to prove wrong the human nature brigade who preach at you and tell you that you're incapable. Why don't you actually get on with it and prove them wrong? Because that's the only way you're going to effectively smash their argument by actually doing it in practice. In fact.
I'd just like to pick up again this question of why people should join the Socialist Party. And I take the point that was made that people have to earn a living. But I think that people also have to make choices, and you have to decide what your priorities are. And it could be the case that, you know, at certain points in your life, then earning a living in a particular kind of way, a kind of job way, you may decide takes priority. But I think that ultimately, people do have to decide where their commitment lies and to take the plunge, even if it means sacrificing something in the short term for a long-term gain. And I would re-emphasise the point that Comrade made at the back about the need to be involved from a democratic point of view, from an organisational point of view. Because, you know, it's easy to say, well, people do things and they're not members. Well, yes, they probably do. But if we're going to be certain that what we're doing is coordinated and, you know, organisationally effective, then we do have to have people who are part of that organisation in order to bring that about.
Sandy.
Yeah. Clifford didn't specifically mention it when he was talking about the democratic angle, but I'm sure he included the policy making of the party. Quite apart from decisions taken in the branches, it's important as many people who agree with Dave and who understand it take part in that. So that's a reason for joining. But also, there is a sort of, in a sense, a sort of cynical reason. The more people we've got in this organisation, the better chance the party has of being taken seriously. So the quicker you join, the better from that point of view. But to come back to what was said, the people not liking to join organisations, the problem is that probably most of the organisations that they have a choice of joining are in some way seriously deficient sort of from a democratic point of view. Now, you know, the point has been made previously in Socialist Party meetings that most trade unions have very democratic constitutions, but the members don't necessarily see it like that. And also, quite apart from how the media feed people with the idea of the trade union barons, the bureaucrats, etc. So the more this sort of propaganda is put over, the more convincing it sounds to people who do see, in fact, that there are people in the trade unions or whatever who will be quite cynical sometimes in jockeying for power, etc. Well, this organisation, whatever its faults may be, and however capable it is of falling down on the participation and what have you, you've got a better chance in this organisation than any other one I can think of actually putting right anything that's wrong because of its democratic structures. So, you know, if you don't like joining organisations, remember that joining this organisation doesn't mean attaching yourself to something else that which is somehow apart from you. You are becoming part of it, one of the owners, if you like, of the Socialist Party.
Well, I think
no.
The
person behind you.
One of the points that Jill made is in fact rather well dealt with in a book which is, I see on the table, a book on a pamphlet, which is on the table, which hasn't been singled out for mention, but is very worthy of people here reading, though it's a bit expensive, as you all have been writing, to deal with the £5 or whatever you ask for, it's too much. But the book there is a new publication, edited by someone who was a member of this party, who has an idea, which I'm not totally convinced of, but has some truth, and if that does go rather contrary to the excessively pessimistic view that Jill expressed, that it's ourselves alone, as they used to say in Ireland. Well, it's pretty near that, I do agree. And I do think that John Crump has this notion of a wider range of people who, whatever shortcomings, and they're very well dealt with in this book, do share with us certain insights into the nature of a desirable future society, that we're not alone in that sense. And there is some in the articles that are there showing about the left communist tradition, aspects of anarchist tradition, and so on. for all their faults, which are as significant, if not more significant, than their merits. The fact is that, at least in terms of groundwork, we're not alone in thinking in terms, in organised terms even, of working for a moneyless, frontierless, classless society of equality and so on. In fact, if one were, by work, for example, to be find oneself in Italy, there's no doubt about it. The starting point of discussion with people would very much be the sort of ideas that Bordiga was once very significant for, although largely forgotten. As distinct from the trendy British left, we've not forgotten Bordiga because they never heard about him. They're too busy propagating his great rival, Gramsci, as a sort of trendy character about whom, when you see a programme or two on him on the TV, you know no more about his ideas than you did to start with. But at least they mention him in the way they don't mention his rival. But this book, which happens to be available, I think overstates that aspect, but one shouldn't disregard the fact that it has some reality, that there are trends which one must be very careful about as to their negative features, but which do suggest that we didn't just come out of nowhere. We ourselves did emerge out of the tradition, and the fact that we emerged from it didn't mean to say that it just ceased there and then to have any sort of input.
I'd just like to say that I'm very pleased to hear that there are these organisations with the same aims and movements with the same aims as us, and I hope that they'll come forward, or we'll go forward to them, and they'll become companion parties, companion movements. Then I'll be even more pleased.
Just back to the point of why don't more people join the party? I think the person behind made a very good point that there are very serious dangers in joining the party, and that I would be delighted to see more people joining the party. People who are committed, people who are sure that they have the courage, must join the party. Because if it's okay saying we've got sympathisers, if we had millions of sympathisers, we could say, yeah, we've got a few members and millions of sympathisers. Wouldn't be very democratic, but we could say that. But, I mean, people who are willing to come along and help with the work should give serious consideration to joining the party. But by the same token, people shouldn't have any illusions about the risk that they take on when they join the party, because we're at the moment a very, very small party. When we start to grow, then we are going to come up against the class struggle in a way which we have never come up against it before. When the capitalists bring out their big guns, then we are going to suffer in the short term. And I don't think anybody should be under any illusions about that. And I think an awful lot of workers are not under any illusions about that, and that's one of the reasons they don't join the party.
I'd just like to say, you say be under no illusions about what the dangers are, and then you don't enlighten us as to what they are. You know, if it's a very dangerous business joining this party, please point out how. I mean, I don't happen to agree.
Excuse me. If you've got a contribution, can you go through the chair, please?
Well, no, I don't.
Do you want me to go on?
Do you want to briefly answer?
Well, briefly, the type of things which happen now, the ridicule which members receive, the persecution that members can receive at work, the blacklisting which can happen, is only done on a very small scale basis because we represent a very small scale of danger. When we start to represent a real danger, then I'm pretty sure that that type of thing is going to increase, and people have to be prepared for it. And I think some people are genuinely afraid that if they commit themselves on that level, then they have neither the resources nor the courage to go ahead, and I for one can't blame them.
Yes, I think that...
the reverse is the case in relation to this risk that is involved. I would say, looking at it from experience and by deduction, that in fact, when more and more people join, it would be much more difficult to discriminate. As a matter of fact, when it suits the employing class, the capitalist class, to deal with somebody that they think is dangerous, it's much easier to do it when it's a small organisation, surely. And on the basis that we are saying that there has to be a majority of socialists before you get socialism, well, I've never held the view that a majority of socialists necessarily means that they're all in the party. I think that there is a responsibility, a very urgent responsibility, and as it was pointed out by Jamie Smith, that people have to make this choice. Nevertheless, I think that there will be thousands of people who would readily agree with us if we became a real power as a socialist party, who would not join and not necessarily have read the three volumes of Marx or anything like that, but would readily see the advantages and the desirability of socialism. So I think that, you know, this business of risk, I know there's a certain amount of risk involved, but I would say that the larger the party, the less the risk involved.
Just to respond to the point made at the front there, that the risk joining the party, I mean, there's a risk in crossing the road.
Yeah.
You've got to calculate is what the, you know, the difference in risks are. I mean, the risk of continuing capitalism, the risk of, you know, with its weapons, its sort of inbuilt drive towards self-destruction, seems to me far more dangerous and far more risk than actually joining a socialist party or getting involved in bringing socialism about. I mean, that is the real choice that confronts workers. And, you know, somebody who can sort of differentiate between risks, it seems to me that joining a socialist party is far more desirable than waiting for self-destruction to arrive.